Lebanon. Explain how this all fits in.
Well, this is a trial that's been going on for 4 years. Netanyahu has been trying to elude a reckoning related to these charges for that much time. And what he constantly does is to wrap himself in the mantle of leadership. And so what better way to do that? And this is a tried and true political formula, as grisly and as grotesque as it is to wage war, is to continue to use weapons and say we're in danger of being annihilated, so we must strike back. But I mean, the destruction that's going on in Gaza, for example, is a kind of wanton destruction at this point that is just beyond any kind of moral reckoning. So I think that also the United States bears some responsibility for this. That's why we included those clips of him at the Congress. You know, we supply Israel with so much aid and so much.
And to be clear, Sada, his wife, and when she's being questioned, she yells at the police and says, "Do you know how he's treated in the United States?" when he addresses a joint session of Congress. Alex Gibney, we're going to have to leave it there. Academy Award-winning filmmaker and producer of The Beebe Files. His next film is about Luigi Mangione and the shooting of the UnitedHealthcare CEO. I'm Amy Goodman. Happy birthday, Jeff Stout.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
We know a KBOO community membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season. Give the gift of supporting grassroots community media by making a donation during KBOO's Catalog of Connections campaign now through December 31st. Our $75,000 goal will go towards everyone's favorite music, news, and public affairs programming all year long. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you and happy holidays.
Hey everybody, tune in Saturday, December 21st at 5 o'clock for Blues Junction. We're spreading some holiday cheer with singer-songwriter Mark Lemhouse. He's a blues man, and he's got some new music coming out here. I've invited him to come out and do a live performance and interview, and who knows, maybe he'll squeeze in a holiday tune. So again, that's Mark Lemhouse, Saturday, December 21st. You're invited. Winter's now fading, and I won't have to stay.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-the-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Wednesday is the final meeting of Portland's outgoing form of government. Oregon officials consider limiting how much utility companies can hike their rates. And an EPA loan puts a Bull Run filtration system one step closer for the Portland metro area. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 17, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Tomorrow, Wednesday, December 18th, will be the final City Council meeting of the Commission Form of Government. It will also be the first City Council meeting in the newly renovated Council Chambers. Portlanders approved an overhaul of their city government in 2022, and it becomes a reality in a few short days. In November, they elected 12 City Councilors from 4 geographic districts, and on Thursday, they'll be sworn into office. The first official meeting of the new City Council will be January 2nd, when the Councilors will elect a Council President and Vice President. It's a new frontier for Portland city leaders and for how the government operates. The city councilors will need to form legislative committees on a variety of topics. The mayor will head up all of the city's administrative functions and will carry out the policies passed by the council alongside the city administrator. Since the election was certified, city councilors have been in onboarding sessions to learn about the new roles and responsibilities. The final meeting of Portland's outgoing form of government starts Wednesday at 9:30 a.m. A proposed cap on electricity rates for PGE and Pacific Power may be bringing some relief to Oregonians who are struggling to pay their bills this winter. The Oregon Public Utility Commission is deciding this week whether or not to cap rate hikes between 7% and 10% annually. Isabelle Charlet reports.
After years of double-digit rate hikes on electricity bills, some relief might be in sight. Oregon Citizens Utility Board, or CUB, has proposed a 7 to 10% yearly limit on rate increases for PGE and Pacific Power. It is up to the Oregon Public Utility Commission to approve the proposal, and it will be making a decision this week. Bob Jenks with CUB says customers are struggling to absorb the 40 or 50% rate hikes from the last few years, and that something needs to be done to rein in this trend.
We're concerned that this isn't going to stop. This is in the interest of utilities to keep raising rates like this as long as they can.
Last winter's ice storm led to record power shutoffs for Oregon households due to lack of payment of their utility bills. If the PUC decides to adopt the cap, then PGE's planned 10.9% increase and Pacific Power's planned 14.9% increase for January would need to be lowered. Jenks says the system favors large companies, which pay much lower rates than households. While industries need less infrastructure due to proximity to power supplies, he notes that new data centers are driving the need to grow the grid. Yet residential rates are rising more than three times faster than industrial rates.
We think that residential customers and small business customers are being asked to subsidize the big server farms, the big data centers, like Amazon and Meta.
The Portland suburb of Hillsboro is newly home to many power-hungry data centers. Jenks says PGE's recent numbers show the centers use more electricity than all of the residents in Washington County combined, and those numbers are expected to keep growing. Jenks says CUB's proposal requires the PUC to mitigate rate increases that are higher than 10%. They can do that by deferring part of the increase to the following year or by setting the rate to the lowest level legally allowed that would still be profitable for the utility.
Needless to say, the utilities don't agree.
I'm Isabelle Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Portland's Bull Run Water Filtration Facility is one step closer to being realized. The Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, approved a $319 million loan to the city for construction. 1 million Oregonians in the Tri-County area rely on Bull Run for clean drinking water. The loan will go towards building a 50-acre Bull Run treatment project in Multnomah County. The total cost of the build is estimated to be $2 billion and will take 4 to 5 years. But once it's built, it will be able to filter out pathogens from the Bull Run water source. That's important because environmental hazards are becoming more commonplace because of climate change. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler said, quote, "Last summer, a wildfire burned within 2 miles of our drinking water facilities in the Bull Run. Filtration is the versatile solution Portland needs to address water quality risks posed by the seismic, wildfire, and weather-related issues we will face in the future." The Bull Run loan from the EPA is the largest contribution from the agency to a drinking water project ever. Parents of children who are in youth detention centers in Washington state say they're concerned for their children's well-being. Because of overcrowding at Green Hill School in Chehalis, Washington, Governor Jay Inslee has proposed a new youth prison in the state. Eric Tegedoff has more.
The holiday season is a difficult time of year for families with children in youth detention centers. Families have limited access to children in prisons. Rashida Robbins has a kid in Green Hill School, a 180-bed facility in Chehalis, Washington. She says families were invited to holiday dinners in early December, but Robbins notes this was long before Christmas, and on that day, she says, there will be a hole in her home that can't be filled.
It's pretty tough, and the lack of access to him during these times makes it even tougher. The thought of him just sitting in a locked room makes it unbearable. As a parent, it's really rough.
Governor Jay Inslee has announced a proposal for a new youth facility to address overcrowding, specifically at Green Hill. Organizations including Kids Are Kids and Team Child have criticized the plan, saying it doesn't address the current concerns at Green Hill. Stacy Stanaway says unaddressed issues have been the case for her son, who suffered from behavioral challenges before he was sent to Green Hill. She says that disciplinary action meant she wasn't able to visit for the family holiday earlier in the month.
We can't just isolate people from their family, from their community, and expect things to just go away. And so with my son, the holidays especially are really, really difficult for us. because he has younger siblings, he has older siblings.
A spokesperson for Green Hills says because the holiday event involved a high number of visitors, the behavior expectations leading up to the event were no physical aggression and drug use 30 days in advance for safety reasons. Stanaway says much of the healing for her boy will have to happen after he comes back from the youth facility.
It's going to be a phase and a period of time that's going to take years, in reality, of recovery for my child. I feel that time is paused right now.
Robin says sometimes it feels like kids are never meant to get out of a facility like Green Hill. She implores state leaders to do something.
So I would challenge the people that have the power to make changes to do so and be on the right side of history.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
An audit of the Portland Parks Levy, passed by voters in 2020, shows the department spent the funds as the voters intended, and they were transparent about it. That's not nothing. Notably, other Portland and Multnomah County departments have not fared so well on their performance audits. The five-year Parks Levy takes a property tax of 80 cents per $1,000 of assessed value. It's estimated to raise over $239 million over 5 years. The levy funds the care of neighborhood parks and natural areas, tending trees, and recreational programs. That five-year levy is nearly up, though, and it remains to be seen what will replace it. Earlier this year, city leaders floated the idea of a combined arts and parks levy, or a combined parks and fire department levy. Polling by FM3 Research this summer showed strong support from survey respondents to double the levy amount for parks alone. 61% of respondents said they would support a combined arts and parks tax, a smaller amount than parks alone. Any replacement for the parks levy will need to be placed on the May 2025 ballot. The American Postal Workers Union says new changes will lead to slower mail deliveries, especially in rural areas. The proposed changes would cancel afternoon deliveries to places that are further from regional processing centers. The Postal Service says most mail delivery will not be impacted. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
The American Postal Workers Union is pushing back against proposed changes to the Postal Service that they say would slow delivery. Among other things, the proposal aims to cancel afternoon deliveries and pickups for areas that are more than 50 miles from a regional hub. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy says elimination of night pickups could save the post office more than $3 billion a year. Daniel Cortez with the Oregon Postal Workers Union says reducing services does not make sense financially.
To think that eliminating services, reducing standards, basically providing the American people with less reliable service is somehow going to make money. It's nonsense.
This is the most recent in a series of changes included in DeJoy's 10-year Delivering for America plan. The union says DeJoy, who was appointed under President Donald Trump, has already raised prices for stamps while closing post offices around the country, especially in rural communities. Cortez says although rural communities would be hit hardest by this latest proposal, urban centers will also be impacted. He explains that the Postal Service has been shutting down processing centers in the state, making Portland the sole distribution site for all of Oregon. This means more mail delays for everyone, including Portlanders.
If the clerks in the employees in the main plant are processing mail for the rest of the region, that means they're not at that same time processing Portland's mail.
These changes come as first-class mail volume has fallen 30% in a decade, with fierce next-day delivery competition. Although the Postal Service says under the new proposal, most first-class mail will not be impacted, Cortez argues management is already failing to meet its lowered delivery standards from 2021. He says mail never used to sit around.
First-class mail was always moving until it got to where it needed to go, and that's just what everybody understood about the service that we're required to provide to the American people.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
A deadly school shooting is under investigation in Wisconsin. The Electoral College convenes today as the Senate considers abolishing it. And Trump discusses media lawsuits, TikTok's future, and drone sightings in a scattered news conference. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Every child, every person in that building is a victim and will be a victim forever.
Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes says right now they don't know the motive for a deadly shooting at a private Christian school in Wisconsin. A teacher and student were killed, and several injured. The shooter was a student who likely died by suicide. This comes 2 days after the 12th anniversary of the Sandy Hook school shooting. Electoral College delegates are gathering across the country to formally cast their votes for the next president. The Electoral College allocates electoral votes to each state based on their congressional representation. Patricia Crowley with the League of Women Voters in Illinois says that structure means candidates can win even when they lose the popular vote.
The Electoral College turns losers into winners. A direct popular vote would solve this problem. You would just go with the candidate with the most votes. And this is not an abstract problem. It's happened 5 times in our history.
A constitutional amendment was just introduced in the Senate that would abolish the Electoral College, noting it disenfranchises millions of Americans. Some blue states are also considering making their delegates vote for the popular winner, but only if enough states do the same. In a scattered press conference from Mar-a-Lago, President-elect Donald Trump suggested he may sue influencers in newspapers after ABC News settled his defamation lawsuit.
I'm doing this not because I want to. I'm doing this because I feel I have an obligation to.
During the conference, the president-elect described himself as a big believer in the polio vaccine and said he might block enforcement of a law that could ban TikTok. With a deadline looming, the social media company is asking the Supreme Court to intervene. Trump also criticized the Pentagon and President Joe Biden for not revealing more about the hundreds of recent drone sightings from New Jersey to Ohio.
Our military knows and our president knows, and for some reason they want to keep people in suspense.
Also Monday, Senate Majority Leader and New York Democrat Chuck Schumer asked Homeland Security to deploy wide-ranging radar systems capable of detecting drones to New York and New Jersey.
There certainly is the technology that can track the craft with precision and determine what the heck is going on.
With no budget stopgap in sight, lawmakers are returning to Capitol Hill. Government funding lapses Friday night unless Congress acts. The holdups include a dispute over how to extend farm bill programs and provide relief to agriculture. Arkansas Republican Senator John Bozeman says farmers are struggling with high production costs.
When you pencil it out and you look at what they're going to receive for their crops, they're going in the hole. If you're growing something right now, you're losing many, many dollars per acre.
One plan would offer more than $10 billion in aid, but there's debates over the scope of the assistance and how it would be structured. Some Republicans are questioning the cost. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to an end-of-the-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Anthony Grasso, author of the just-released book, Dual Justice, America's Divergent Approaches to Street and Corporate Crime. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with some rain showers and a wind advisory until early tomorrow morning. The low will be 43 degrees. Tomorrow, it will be partly cloudy with a daytime high of 55. Today in history, in 1903, the Wright brothers make the first controlled-powered heavier-than-air flight in the Wright Flyer at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. The quote of the day is from English actor Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree, who said, quote, "Never say a humorous thing to a man who does not possess humor. He will always use it in evidence against you." The EPA has made cleaning up Superfund sites on Upper Columbia River beaches a priority. They were polluted with arsenic and lead by a Canadian smelter upriver. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has officially added the Upper Columbia River to its Superfund priority cleanup list. Steve Jackson reports.
Beaches of the Upper Columbia near Northport, Washington have been polluted by heavy metals like lead and arsenic for decades. primarily from a smelter located on the Canadian side of the border. Studies of how to do remediation and some actual cleanup have been going on for a few years, but the official Superfund status will provide guaranteed funding for much more cleanup, as well as to help coordinate the various studies on human and environmental health threats. Regional Administrator for Region 10 of EPA, Casey Sixkiller, says both the Spokane and Colville Confederated Tribes have been supportive of adding the Superfund designation.
Tribal members are hunting and they're fishing and they're consuming those resources. And so they obviously have a vested interest in ensuring that the food that people, that their tribal members are consuming is not unhealthy for them.
The Colville tribes have been engaged in litigation for over 20 years with the Canadian company, Teck, to try to get them to take responsibility for the cleanup of the area. So far, EPA has cleaned up 59 residential properties and says at least 150 more need to be done. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
An Arizona Democrat is calling on the White House to free Native activist Leonard Peltier, who's serving two life sentences for an incident that took place nearly 50 years ago on the Pine Ridge Reservation that led to a shootout between American Indian Movement members and two FBI agents. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger has more.
U.S. Representative Raul Grijalva, a Democrat from Tucson, views this moment as Peltier's last chance at freedom. He and 30 other congressional Democrats are calling on outgoing President Joe Biden to pardon Peltier.
This effort is probably one of the few, if any, left in order to turn this around.
In July of this year, the U.S. Parole Commission denied Peltier's release. He's currently serving time at a federal prison in Florida. In a letter to the Parole Commission, FBI Director Christopher Wray said Peltier murdered the young agents in cold blood. He urged the commission in the strongest terms possible to deny Peltier's parole. Wray says he will step down as FBI Director when the Biden administration ends in January. Earlier this month, President Biden designated a national monument at the Carlisle Indian Boarding School in Pennsylvania. This follows a formal apology by Biden in October on behalf of the U.S. government for the schools and policies that supported the boarding schools. Peltier is seen as a symbol of racism and oppression against Native Americans by the U.S. criminal justice system. Some call him America's longest-serving political prisoner, who is also a boarding school survivor. Representative Grijalva says Peltier's release could add to Biden's legacy.
The legacy is to turn around something that fundamentally was wrong. The legacy is to place the issues of injustice and rights of indigenous people right at the center of the discussion. You know, and that continues to be the issue.
For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger.
The Oneida Nation in New York and Colgate University met Monday for the repatriation of remains of 21 Oneida ancestors, which were removed from sites on tribal ancestral lands between the 1950s and 80s. They were held by the university's Anthropology Museum. In 2022, more than 1,500 cultural items were transferred from the museum to the tribe, and the university formally apologized. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Health experts often remind those celebrating the holiday season to not overindulge and do all they can to keep the added stress at bay. Research continues to emerge about how all of these factors likely contribute to an uptick in heart attacks this time of year. Mike Moen has the story.
From hosting family to higher credit card bills to increased alcohol consumption, the holiday season, while fun, isn't always friendly to our health. A Minnesota expert says to avoid a cardiac event, give yourself a gift by not letting bad habits take hold. Findings from the American Heart Association show that more cardiac deaths occur on December 25th than any other day of the year. Coming in second is December 26th, while January 1st rounds out the top three. The University of Minnesota's Dr. Sama Hosseini says there's no firm reason behind those spikes this time of year, but he says it's fair to link them with temporary lifestyle changes.
People are sleeping less. It's changing the way we eat. It's changing the frequency of which we drink alcohol.
And he says because of travel or health clinics scaling back availability, people sometimes have gaps over the holidays when it comes to screenings or other appointments. Hosseini recommends trying to fit in as much exercise as possible and limit unhealthy foods when not at a holiday party. Drinking alcohol in moderation is another tip. As for those with existing medical conditions, Hossein says the holidays aren't meant to take a vacation from your special health needs. He says it's important to keep taking your medications and make sure they're refilled. As for the research, he says the higher death totals aren't exclusive to colder climates, where blood flow can be restricted when the temperature drops.
This has been shown in the United States. It has also been shown in a country like New Zealand, where the Christmas time and the New Year time is actually in summer.
Health experts say it's important to know the warning signs, such as chest discomfort, discomfort in the arms, and shortness of breath. When there are obvious signs, calling 911 right away is deemed vital, as well as knowing how to provide hands-only CPR. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
As policymakers plan the energy grid of the future, the National Wildlife Federation has released two reports on the ways onshore and offshore transmission lines affect wildlife and help in the fight against climate change. Suzanne Potter has the details.
The power grid will need to be dramatically upgraded and expanded in the coming years to handle the transition to renewable energy. And two new reports look at the impact on wildlife, both on and offshore. The placement of large onshore power grids can greatly affect migratory species such as mule deer, elk, and sage grouse. Veronica Ung-Kono is a clean energy policy transmission specialist with the National Wildlife Federation.
Proactively planning transmission development helps to strike a balance that can help wildlife have their needs met while also helping people have access to low cost and clean energy.
Ung-Kono says more research is needed because there's still a lot we don't know about the implications for wildlife as more transmission lines crisscross the landscape. A second report on offshore wind farms recommends buffer zones around the floating turbines and anchoring plans that avoid sensitive habitat like coral reefs. It also says cables must be shielded and buried to reduce impacts from electromagnetic fields. Co-author Shana Steingard with the National Wildlife Federation says if it's done right, the clean energy transition will preserve habitat and slow ocean warming and sea level rise linked to climate change.
Climate change presents an existential threat to all species, particularly ocean species. The threat from offshore wind development pale in comparison to the threats of not addressing climate change. There is no climate solution without offshore wind.
President-elect Trump has vowed to kill offshore wind development. So far, site surveys are underway for the five wind farms planned off of the California coast, but none has been approved. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Democracies around the world are having to deal with new forms of internal and external pressures, not all from the far right. How democratic governments handle these pressures, especially abuses of power, may hold lessons for us in the next Trump era. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Winston Churchill famously said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. Churchill understood how fragile and manipulable democracy is. Here are some examples of democracies in trouble. In South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol, who was elected in 2022, declared martial law on December 3rd, but the National Assembly unanimously voted to overturn his order. Yoon followed the Constitution, which requires that he accept the National Assembly's vote. Thus, martial law lasted only about 6 hours. It seemed that democracy in South Korea had worked, though his call on the military to support him against the legislature was a reminder of military dictatorships in the past. President Yoon has not apologized for his action or withdrawn his claim that he was forced to act because of threats from pro-North Korean politicians. Now he has been impeached a second time and suspended from office. His fate is in the hands of a constitutional court. In Brazil, the federal police concluded a lengthy investigation into right-wing conspiracies to violently dismantle the constitutional state after Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's election win in January 2023. Among the 37 conspirators charged are Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, and several of his former ministers. The long-awaited conclusion of the police investigation comes after federal police officers made 5 arrests as part of a roundup of alleged members of a plot to assassinate Lula and his vice president, as well as the Supreme Court judge. In the Republic of Georgia, The October 26 parliamentary election was widely seen as a referendum on the country's aspirations to join the European Union, which is overwhelmingly popular. The pro-Russian Georgian Dream Party won, but evidence is abundant that the vote was rigged with help from Russia. Georgia's prime minister has decided to delay by 4 years its application to join the EU, despite the fact that Georgia's constitution stipulates that the country's goal is to join it. The opposition continues to hold massive demonstrations and a boycott of parliament, enabling Georgian Dream to elect a president hostile to the West, while the sitting president insists she will not leave office, saying the government is illegitimate. A government crackdown is underway. Masked government agents hauled away a leader of the opposition in full view of journalists. And in Romania, the first round of a presidential election was voided by judges of the Constitutional Court after the winner, Kelen Georgescu, a far-right political unknown who polled 1% on November 5th, emerged with 23% on November 26th. The court cited declassified intelligence documents that detailed allegations of Russian influence operations on social media, mainly TikTok, which nearly half of all Romanians use. Georgescu admires Putin and parrots the Russian line on NATO and Ukraine. He has many times questioned NATO's value in providing security for Romania. He will face Elena Lasconi, the pro-Europe candidate of the ruling Social Democratic Party, in a new election. Pro-European parties hold two-thirds of the seats in parliament, and they have formed a grand coalition to counteract the pro-right trend in Romanian politics. Next, in France. The president, Emmanuel Macron, may have thought he had outfoxed the left and right back in September when he called a snap National Assembly election in which his centrist party came in third. But when the left and right couldn't agree on a candidate for premier, Macron appointed Michel Barnier. After only 3 months, Barnier was forced to tender his resignation after a no-confidence